Robert Palmer was a music critic and a musician. Yoko Ono once said that she, John Lennon, and Palmer touched each other's spirit. Robbie Robertson of The Band said that for Palmer, music was a religion. Palmer's fellow critic Anthony DeCurtis has edited a new book called Blues and Chaos, The Music Writing of Robert Palmer, and Palmer's daughter, Augusta Palmer, recently made a documentary about her father called The Hand of Fatima. In a rare joint interview, Anthony DeCurtis and Augusta Palmer joined Steve Paulson to talk about the life and work of Robert Palmer. DeCurtis explained what he liked so much about Palmer's writing.
I was always kind of struck by both the intelligence and the passion of his writing. I mean, as somebody who was in graduate school, I was really impressed by Bob's ability to bring sophisticated musical ideas to the mainstream, which is, on my best day, what I'd like to feel I ended up doing as well. He set a kind of standard in that regard. And particularly, you know, in the kind of heyday of punk, I was in graduate school in Bloomington, Indiana, and I was reading Bob and John Rockwell in the New York Times, and those guys were just hammering. I mean, they were really covering a very insurgent and subversive music in the New York Times with the same kind of force that the New York Times was associated covering other aspects of the arts. I mean, those guys did not make any distinction between something that was going on at CBGB and something that was going on at Lincoln Center. So that is a part of Bob that I really admired, you know, that ability to kind of walk into any musical environment and make some sense out of it and deliver that, his comprehension, to an audience.
And the way you put it in the introduction to your book, he blended elegance with hipster enthusiasm.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there was a kind of sense. I mean, Robbie Robertson from The Band, you know, who knew Bob well and whom I interviewed for Bob's obituary, unfortunately, and for this introduction, you know, remarked about Bob, even as polite and friendly a person as he was, you know, there was a very clear sense on his part that he had better taste than just about anyone. And that was evident, you know, when you did speak to him in a way that was not particularly imposed. I mean, when Bob spoke, there was a feeling of, I want to put this in a way that doesn't sound pretentious, because there wasn't really any pretension in him. It was kind of like, this is what this is about, period. You know, there was a seriousness of intent, a kind of thing like, look, you know, I've given this a lot of thought. I care about it more than just about anyone. And here's my take.
Well, and the other thing that comes through in a lot of the stuff that's been written about him is that music was more than just a passion for him. It was almost a religion. I mean, that's the word that some people use. And in fact, you say that he wasn't a religious person in any traditional sense, but it was through music that he sought transcendence.
Exactly. And I think that was a more complicated process. Yeah, I mean, for a variety of reasons. I mean, you know, certainly Bob struggled with addiction in his life. I think there were elements of his life that he very much wanted to transcend. And I think, you know, just like all of us, I mean, you feel trapped in your body and you feel, you know, you're in a world and you wonder what's beyond it. And I think Bob saw music and heard music as a route to that other world. And he found it in a lot of places and, again, managed to communicate it very effectively.
Well, Augusta, let me bring you into this discussion, because certainly this is one of the themes in your film about your father, that music was his religion. How far would you take that assessment?
Yeah, I would say that's absolutely true. And like Anthony said in the introduction, he wasn't a religious person in a kind of traditional or conventional sense of that, but he was a very deeply spiritual person and was really into understanding what made the world work. As his friend Bashir Attar of the Master Musician says, who mixes the ocean? He wanted to find that out. I do too.
But fabulous.
Yeah,
well, and,
yeah.
And clearly it came at a cost to those people closest to him, to you, over a period of time, to his various wives. You say his life was music, but that didn't always include you.
Well, I think because he was so hooked into that, I think it was really hard for him to make time and space for other people in his life if they didn't seem to be going along the same groove. Once I really got to know him as a teenager, you know, that wasn't so much of an issue. And actually, I think one thing that maybe doesn't come off as much as it could in the film is that we did actually develop a really great relationship, and that it was fantastic as a teenager to be talked to like an adult in that inclusive way. He would talk to me the same way he would talk to Anthony, or the same way he would talk to Yoko Ono, because he was just him. And he felt very confident in that and in having the best taste in the world.
But we should point out that he left your mother when you were 1 month old. And you say that he stayed totally out of your life until you were, what, 12?
Yes, that's true. And that's something that's hard to get over. I think there are a lot of complicated things that you could go into about why that was. He wanted to be in New York, and my mother and I lived in Little Rock, Arkansas. And I think it was also one of those things where once you've made that decision to go down that road, it's hard to make the U-turn and sort of admit that you've been wrong. So it took him a long time to do that, and probably took some pressure from other people in his life, like his wife at that time, Deborah Ray Cohen, and his mother, who, strangely enough, I think this is one of the most bizarre things about the story, is that I saw my grandmother, my dad's mother, every week. And his grandparents, my great-grandparents as well, were a big part of my life. But they never mentioned him.
We all respected him highly, especially the musicians. We all loved him. He was the conscience. He was the superb intelligence in the music world.
And what's remarkable for a man who became known mainly as a rock critic is how highly regarded he was by various prominent musicians, from Mick Jagger and Yoko Ono to Bono and the jazz great Ornette Coleman. This is practically unheard of for a music critic to be thought of so highly by these kinds of people.
Well, yeah, and I think part of that was that Bob neither pandered to these characters, nor did he kind of stint on the degree to which he admired them. Someone like Mick Jagger, I mean, the Rolling Stones were extremely important in Bob's thinking, and also kind of as his buddies. And, you know, he didn't recognize a lot of those lines. I'm sure the New York Times wouldn't have been happy to learn Bob was up to whatever hours doing whatever things with Keith Richards, listening to old blues records. You know, that's not in the journalism handbook. You know, it certainly is part of who he was, and I think it very much informed his writing about that band and about that music. He identified with musicians, and I think musicians felt a kindred spirit in him, I think.
And for one thing, he would sometimes jam with them, right? With, like, the Rolling Stones. I mean, he was playing music with them.
On clarinet, yeah, exactly. I mean, I think they enjoyed it. I mean, I think with someone like Ornette Coleman, I think that there was a kind of more serious quest going on there musically. I think Bob felt with the Rolling Stones, like, why shouldn't he be up there, you know, with his clarinet? I mean, Jagger, when he was telling me about that, was laughing. He'd always just, like, break out that clarinet and, you know, jam with us. And they enjoyed it. You know, they got a kick out of it, but it wasn't necessarily like, oh, this is really going to take this particular song to another level. Whereas I think, you know, with obviously with someone like Ornette, I think that was the goal. You know, I mean, I think they were going to the same place.
What do you think he was looking for in music?
I think he wanted to get to some other place. I think that's what he wanted. And whether that was through the blues or through the master musicians of Jujuka or through, you know, really wild jazz, or I think he wanted to go. You know, that was his thing. You know, I think...
Go in what sense? In kind of a Dionysian sense?
Let's get out of here.
The, you know, Brian Gysin here to go. You know, that's what we're here for.
Yeah, or, you know, that kind of Tom Gysin. Like,
transcend,
man, I gotta go. Yeah, like that kind of, sort of a beat thing, you know, and yeah, and that kind of transcendent, like let's just kind of, you know, turn on the jets here and set the controls for the heart of the sun. I think that's that was the drive.
I studied their music and their magic, took part in trance rituals with hundreds of mountain tribesmen, and finally succumbed to the insistent trance rhythms myself. These and other experiences culminating in my adoption into the Attar family in 1973 called all my beliefs and assumptions about how the world works into question.
Now, one of the curiosities of Robert Palmer's story is why he gravitated so profoundly to the master musicians of Jujuka, this musical group in Morocco. Have either of you come to understand this?
I think I have. And I think a large part of that was by going there and being able to hear that music for hours and hours on end. I mean, in the film, you only get to hear it for a brief period. But part of the music, the way that music works on you, is by listening to it for four or more hours at a time, usually around 3 a.m.
This is the kind of music that does take you somewhere?
It definitely takes you somewhere. When I talked to Donovan about that music, we had this great conversation. When I looked back at some of the footage, I was like, no one will have any idea what we're talking about. And that was actually the problem in making a film about Jijuka, because I would say to people, Jijuka, and they'd say, yeah, it was great.
Weren't there often also a lot of psychedelic drugs that were part of the musical experience?
Absolutely, absolutely, there were. One reviewer in the Times said maybe the drugs now aren't as good as they were back then. And that may be true, too. But I think that also misses the point of the experience, that it's really the purity of that music. And whatever you cut it with, if you want to cut it with LSD or a lot of keef, rock and mixture of pot and marijuana, that might help you out. But I think the music by itself has plenty to get you to another place.
Yeah, I should say, I mean, about the drugs, I mean, look, we all know they kill people. Yeah, we all know that they're dangerous. But people have been using drugs for centuries to enhance certain types of religious, spiritual experiences. And in part, that's what Bob was doing. He was also killing himself. There's no doubt about that. But there's part of him in those moments, like in Morocco, and I would say even in other situations, where to just lose intellect, you know, or lose consciousness, to just experience, to just be in the presence of that music, I think that was part of his goal. Part of his goal in Morocco, and I think part of his goal even when he was doing things that would ultimately hurt him.
I'm reminded of something my dad once wrote. How much thought can be hidden in a few short lines of poetry? How much history can be transmitted by pressure on a guitar string? The thought of generations, the history of every human being who's ever felt the blues come down like showers of rain.
Anthony, I want to come back to the business of being a rock critic, because there are very different ideas about how one should do this. So I have to ask you, what makes a great critic?
Well, I like writers who are knowledgeable, who write well, and who aren't necessarily into, I don't know, kind of imposing themselves on their subjects. If you read Bob's writing, I mean, as much as, you know, he was in there with a lot of, I mean, he hung out with a lot of these people, when you read his writing, there's a certain reserve. For all that he knew, he's never condescending. There isn't any snarkiness. I mean, occasionally, like in writing about Madonna, for example, you know, I think that, you know, he kind of felt like, okay, look, if I've got to go do this, then, you know, this is what it is, and I can't even be bothered to think about it. But Bob was drawn to the things that he liked. He saw his job as kind of turning people on to things that he believed were important and that he thought were good.
Augusta, you say at the beginning of your film that it's been 8 years since your father died. I'm sure it's been more than that by now. But you also say you're still looking for him. Do you feel like you eventually found him?
I do. I feel like the process of making the film, and one of the greatest parts of that was making the animation that's based on his writing, some of which I actually made even before I went to Morocco, and other parts of which I made afterwards. I mean, that allowed me to kind of inhabit his voice in a way that was really wonderful for me. So that was a huge part. And then being in Jijuka and feeling a part of that family and feeling really moved by that music. When I approached it, I have to say, with some skepticism before, that really surprised me and changed me. And I feel put me pretty closely in touch with him and who he was. My dad's encounter with Jijuka tied a knot in his heart that sometimes excluded me. But somehow, by retracing his footsteps, I found something I never expected. a family formed in music, a family unlike any other, but open to anyone who's willing to listen.
Augusta Palmer is the daughter of the music critic Robert Palmer. She's also the maker of a documentary about her father called The Hand of Fatima. Anthony DeCurtis is a longtime contributing editor at Rolling Stone. He's also the editor of the book Blues and Chaos, the music writing of Robert Palmer. DeCurtis and Augusta Palmer spoke with Steve Paulson.